so many times, even as adults, you look around and you think people, everybody else has it together and you don't. And you can just imagine in a child who sometimes hasn't comprehended that you are in the process of learning and you will be fine, how much more exacerbated the feeling of not being okay is. You know what I mean? Like, you see it in the story of Wanda where she says, you know, like, but why am I the only one who struggles like this? Maybe my hair is a crown, but one made of thorns. And I think when that feeling of being isolated is so exaggerated, really stories can meet kids at that very point of need, even when you as a parent aren't yet aware of really how alone she may feel in that particular experience, that stories can become friends. And I think those friends are really necessary to holding a child on their journey.
What language do you dream in? When you're in love, happy, or angry, what words do you say? Which songs make you dance? We may have DNA, flesh, and blood in common with many creatures on Earth, but it's the expression and appreciation of art, music, and stories that sets us apart as humans and allows us to be authentically ourselves. Typically, your family, community, and society make you feel like you have inherent value and you belong. The freedom to be yourself and have fun is best learned at a young age when you hear stories in your native tongue. And in South Africa, we celebrate a diversity of 12 official languages.
We are at home. I speak to my child in Zulu. My child goes out on the streets. They speak Zulu. And when this child goes to school, then he finds an English book, this child. Mm. Then he needs to read in the language that he does not even know. You know, he knows nothing of this language. The only language he knows is the language that he has been speaking at home and with his friends on the streets. That's the language that he knows. So when this child gets to school, it's English, boo. This language, now they need to associate reading with excitement. Now, this language that they do not know, everything is spoken in this language. They are being taught in this language. Then how do children begin to like reading? So it is for that idea that we are saying that children must have the opportunity to be read to in the language that they know, in the language that they understand, the language that is spoken at home, so that when they read, when they are being read to, when they meet literacy at that early age, they will enjoy, because this is the language they know. This is the language that is spoken at home, and they will begin to associate reading with fun.
That was Bongani Godide from an organization called Nalibali, speaking about the importance of first language stories on World Read Aloud Day. Nalibali Isikosa for Here's the Story is a national reading for enjoyment campaign to spark a love of stories, build literacy, and promote lifelong reading culture. Through Nalibali, you can access books written by children and adults, audio stories streamed on the website, and tales told aloud on WhatsApp in 11 languages. We can agree from an educational point of view, we need to create safe spaces for young people to use their imaginations and hear and tell stories. But stories, poetry, and art can also play a role in moving our society forward, empowering our youth to bring about real change.
Art is for everyone, and it is a part of all of us. Its deep roots have the power to supersede language and communicate across cultural boundaries. Art is an historian and an expression of culture. Both are intertwined and so vast that it can't be packaged into tidy and neat concepts. Art may very well evade definition, but we cannot escape its truth. Art has the power to delve below the surface to change actions, affect thoughts, feelings, and belief systems.
Welcome to Season 4 of the Just for a Change podcast, powered by the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Ntombini Marengani. In this season, we've looked at unexpected connections, surprising overlaps, and unusual alignments in the work being done locally and globally that's moving our societies forward in positive ways. This is our final episode for this season, and what a journey it's been. Just a reminder that the views shared by our guests may not necessarily reflect the views of the Birther Center. Another person's creative outpouring, whether a folk tale, a beat, or a sense of style, has the power to move us. It can inspire us, change the way we think, and mobilize us into action. That's the magic of being a human. Our guest for this episode, author Sihle Isipho Nontshokweni, knows firsthand about the power of storytelling. Her children's book, Wanda, about a girl learning to embrace her natural hair, won the Skipping Stones Honor Award in 2021. This accolade is given to books around the world that promote an understanding of cultures, encourage a deeper awareness of diversity, and foster respect for multiple viewpoints within societies. But first, let's hear from Sivuile Mtwetwe.
My name is Sivuile Mtwetwe.
A young entrepreneur who participated in the Changemaker program offered by the Birther Center and UCT's GSB Solution Space. This two-month interactive social entrepreneurship program merges conventional profit-focused business practices with social purpose-driven principles. Sivuile has developed a prototype hair product called Remedy Afrique, which is currently undergoing testing. It's made from local African ingredients that work to stimulate growth and strengthen and maintain hair texture for all hair types. I asked Sivuile to tell me more about how the idea came about and why he decided to use traditional African ingredients in his formula.
So I started to come up with a business to make cosmetic products, specifically hair products, because I wanted to connect the business to myself and my journey as a person. So a little background about myself. When I was still a teenager, I didn't have much hair. So I had to like cut my hair because I had a problem with ringworms that were growing on my head. So in order to treat the ringworms, I had to cut my hair so that it would be much easier to apply all those antibiotics that reduce the fungal infections that cause the ringworms. So that's when I decided to focus on a product that would sort of treat the scalp and also be able to style the hair for those who want to style their hair. I knew that it had to be something organic. So I wanted to use products that could be found in a regular household. For example, rice water. You could use it to create a hair product that can reduce growing gray hairs. So I started to do some research on ingredients that were used by African people in ancient times. I found ingredients like shea butter, the boba fruit, and also castor oil. That is, those products, when combined, they can make a product that promotes growth of the hair and also is able to strengthen your hair and also able to cure your scalp so that it does not get affected by ringworms as me when I was growing up. The reason I decided to include African ingredients in the formula, it's because African people, when they wear their hair, it empowers them. So I wanted to also empower people to wear their hair naturally.
Sivuile's story shows the power of entrepreneurial thinking and how we can do great things when we embrace who we are and where we come from. Our guest for today, best-selling and award-winning author, filmmaker, and podcast host, Sihle Nontshokweni, writes about this intersection of identity and how we show up in the world. Her book, Wanda, co-created with Matabo Hlali, follows a young girl's journey to self-celebration through accepting and loving her hair. The story teaches young people, especially girls, about friendship, consent, negotiating power, bravery, and agency. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sihle. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Davini. I'm very excited to be with you.
How did you become a children's author?
How did I become a children's author? I keep saying this line where it was in search of my mother's garden. I was trying to help my mother publish a manuscript that she had written in 1983. And at the time, she just kept saying this thing, you know, I have this book in my that I want to publish. And eventually, after a while, I just said to her, you know what, listen, let's go and meet publishers, let's meet writers. And I set up a whole, like, meet writers week for them. And I think by the time they arrived at the airport in Cape Town at the time, I had this, like, huge banner that's, like, soon to be authors. And it was in that pursuit to help my mom publish her work that eventually one of the publishers we had connected with during that time then said, hey, do you and your mom want to submit for this children's writing competition? And that's really how that particular door opened to me. I'd always been a person who writes. I had a blog, but I'd never necessarily thought of myself as a children's book writer specifically. But I think that door of trying to be of service to her really became the joy and the miracle in my own life. And it's just been a wondrous journey ever since.
Fantastic. A unifying theme in your work is how race-based stereotypes affect educational and career expectations in the post-apartheid schooling landscape. Tell me more about why this needs to be explored.
I was born in 1990, really at the end of apartheid in South Africa specifically. And my schooling experience was always such a, for my parents specifically, I think they really wanted their own hopes realized and everything that they couldn't have to now become established through the possibilities that had opened up to this child of theirs, right? And so I went to 12 different schools up until where I am right now, where there was a constant, like, there's a better school. There's a way to enter into a better school, right? And I think what I experienced in the South African landscape and even beyond really is the cultural patterns that exist in classrooms, in schools, cultures that almost feel like almost like they've been systematically taught, right? Around your identity, around your place of belonging, around who you can become in the space in which you are in. And I think for me, then starting to realize that the kind of environment you're in shapes, in a way, your sense of identity, your aspirations, what you believe is possible for you. In schools, it was other kinds of incentives and rewards, right? It's who can become prefect, who can become captain, like what is available to you and the testaments of that. And I think that really became an important question, understanding the kind of two-tail education system that we have in this country and what it is people believe that they can have, because I think that's really an essential starting point really to being able to catapult your life forward and be able to pursue the vision that you have for your life. If you have those limiting beliefs and they've been instilled in you, not just by your home environment, but also your schooling environment, which is meant to be the equalizer, you know, like education should be an equalizer. But if that also then perpetuates and highlights those inadequacies and inefficiencies in the social system, what it does, I think, is that it compresses student talent. It compresses the kind of leadership we can have, the kind of possibilities that people can then be able to create to change the world, which I think is what we are all in some way fundamentally here to do. And so I think exploring that effectively and understanding some of those barriers to entry in the identity and in the soul of a child can really help us to unlock potential.
I love that. Education as an equalizer. I think there hasn't been a lot of reflexivity on how the education system actually reproduces the inequalities that we have in this country in particular. And you're right, it actually should be a gateway to the future for our young people. How does your passion for social justice weave its way into your stories?
Oh, in every way, right? Like, I'm a politics graduate and I did my master's in politics. And I think I've always been, like, very conscious of this, like, the deprivation of the soul, right? Like, you know, Ted Gurr's relative deprivation of, like, what other people have, what other people can't have, right? Like, and I think if you look at the story of Wanda, Wanda's a story about an 8-year-old girl. Every single day, her mom turns her hair into this beautiful cloud. And she kind of has to go through this, like, transitionary moment between the school bus and getting into school and what she knows her teacher will say. It sounds like it's just a children's book, but that's really an exploration of a systematic pattern that you see in South African schools, right? So we wrote Wanda in Irish in 2017. That was before the schools protests in 2018. And I think really what that story then really highlighted is the existing patterns, systematic patterns that are already existing in schools that were part of our experience that you then see in children's lives. I think one of my most like politically imbued stories is called it's Chicharito, and it's about an ant that's trying to escape a social estate, right? And move into the kingdom of Zombo, where they can have like, it's like the city that never sleeps. And that story really explores communism versus capitalism for children, but in a really engaged way. I call the queen of that particular story Queen Nyerere, and that's around Julius Nyerere. Their kingdom is called Ujama, right? Ujama. And that's also really based on that social estate. But of course, it's all imbued in storytelling. And I think you can really be able to lift societal aspects, right? Like what it is that people think they yearn for, what individualism versus a collectivism system looks like. And you really just put that into children's work. One of my other stories is called Fly Africa Fly, and it's about a little rural boy who imagines that he's a pilot, and he teaches everybody how to make little pilot papers. And I think everything that I almost want to see in the world, which is a lot of it is justice, it's fairness, it's equality, it's opportunity, I'm almost able to just bring that into the world of imagination for children through stories and equip them in that way. And hoping that that, you know, that belief that you can put into a children's story can really shape their own soul so that they become more, you know, they can become more out of their own lives.
Definitely. I have to tell you, there's a moment in Wanda the Brave where what you're saying about reflecting the transition from home to school, Wanda mentions what her teacher says about her hair. And that really, that hurt.
Yeah,
eh?
She says,
that
she
hurt.
She will say it's a bird's nest. She said this to the other girls before, right? And then in Wanda the Brave, when these two girls meet for the first time, they go to different schools. But the one says, oh, your teacher says the same thing, right? And I think that's about like the systemized like experiences and cultures of school all through a children's book, which is why I think children's books are so powerful. They're
absolutely
so powerful.
Mm. Why did you choose Wanda's hair as a symbol of her identity?
So when I wrote Wanda, actually it was the first transcript of it came as a blog, and it was called African Rapunzel. And it actually, I think in part, was my own story. I'd just started my dreadlocks at the time, and I was living in China. I submitted a picture of myself for an audition with a weave on, and then they called me back, but I'd taken the weave off, you know, and I was saying to my partner, you know, I just don't think they'll think I'm as beautiful with my natural hair. And I think I hadn't been conscious of what I had internalized about beauty, about identity, about worthiness in relation to hair. And I remember them in their own defense saying, well, that would be crazy if they didn't think that, you know? And I think it was in that moment of having somebody else's protection, so to say, that you realize what Lewis Clark says, there's places like this everywhere, places that you enter as young girls and boys from which you never return. And I think then this particular symbol around hair and identity caused me then to reflect on my own question, like, oh, what is it that you've come to believe, right? Like, and even if you don't want to admit that that's what you believe, but all of your actions signal this, right? So if you're going to an event, you have to go and do your hair a certain way, right? Like if you were think of going to a friend's wedding, right? Like there's a particular hairstyle that you would want to do that to you symbolizes beauty. And I think the thing about it is that consistently, it seems like the further away it is from what you naturally are, the better it is. And I think to me, that's just a symbolism of everything else, right? Like, so even the idea of where you went to school growing up, the further away it was from your home, which was really my experience. I went to hostel when I was 6. The further away it is from your environment, from your home, from what you already have been, which is imbued in Black culture, apparently the better it was, right? And I think hair as well becomes such a huge signifier of all the ways we almost self-reject, even without realizing what we're doing, and all the ways in which we don't really embrace how we come and who we are. And even if you like your hair in a different way, but just feeling beautiful in your own skin and in your own hair is such a powerful affirmation of all the ways that you already are without needing anything else outside of you.
Wanda is available in English, Afrikaans, isiZulu, and isiXhosa. Why was it important to publish it in more than one language?
Because I think the same way we speak about hair as being an affair, I think language, right, language is so personal, you know? It is how you, most of the time, how you laugh, you know? Certain kind of like energies that are like really part of what you would say with your family, which is the people that are closest to you. It's such representation of how you connect with the communities that you come from. And I think just being able to learn in your own language, to pick up a book with a girl whose skin looks like yours and also in a language that is yours, I think every single time affirms your right to claim space, you know, to take up the world as you are. And I think language is such an incredible and important affirmer of how we learn. So, yeah, language is a very big part, especially in South Africa, where you have so many cultures that are coded in language. And I think being able to embrace those entirely is an important aspect of what we can become as a country.
Wanda has evolved into a theatre production, a website, an annual festival, and more. Wanda the Brave, the sequel, was released in 2021 and will soon become an animated cartoon. What do you think is the most powerful medium for storytelling in pursuit of social justice?
I think radio and television, which is really scalable media, has such incredible power in being able to reach a multitude of people. I think social media in a way digitalizes what the book is already is, you know. But I think our ability to use television for stories is huge, because if you think about it, many of us who are maybe listening to this podcast, we grew up in different communities, different countries, but we can relate to certain films that we all got to watch together at the same time. And I think what media does is that it actually shapes, right, it social imagination, because you identify to those particular characters, right? So Barbie was a TV show, right? If you think of kids wanting to speak right now in Peppa Pig's accent, which is the English accent, they're getting to watch that. Like, they're like, don't call me, it's daddy. You know, like it's they're Coco Melon. And if you think of what YouTube is doing right now, it's millions of views globally of the exact same shows. And what they get to do, they literally are painting children's like identification to stories. And I think if you're able to scale beyond the book into all those multimedias, there's so much more reach. I think in South Africa, radio is a hugely powerful tool that can reach across communities, into rural communities as well. Multimedia is such an incredibly essential tool in being able to get books and stories out into larger communities.
What stories would you like to see more of in the world?
I think imagination. I'm really excited to see how African stories start to move beyond really correcting elements, which is like really trying to correct things that should have just been fair, you know, like, and into stories of power. I think I want to see more African superheroes, right, with capes and powers and abilities that exceed our natural world. I think part of what stories are meant to do is to ignite our imagination, make us believe in the possibilities of what there is in the world. And so I'm really excited for more sci-fi kind of stories, for more imaginative stories, for more empowering stories, and for global stories. I want to see our stories being the ones where parents are saying, that story is now banned in my house because this child wants to speak like an African, you know, like they're saying this thing that I can't, like, you know, I can't hear it. And therefore I want to ban it. And I just think children's stories, especially because they have such long legs and life, have so much capacity to influence the world. And I just imagine, like, what are all the ways in which we can draw and pull from our various cultures and create a semblance of characters that are coming from here that influence the world globally, and have our kids thinking, oh, kids from America are reading it. Of course, you know our stories, you know? And I think that's really exciting. The prospect of that is something that I want to be a part of.
Yeah. What is the importance of mother tongue teaching and children's books for educators in South Africa?
I mean, I think one of the biggest struggles in the South African education system right now, right, is just thinking about how kids, for instance, will learn in mother tongue, right, up all the way to grade 3. And suddenly, when they get to grade 4, they just change into English learning. And I think there's such a huge gap that happens in being able to comprehend. I think what literature can really do and how we imbue and imbibe stories in that transitionary period around language, right, can be such a powerful source of how we continue to engage children. And I think there's a way to tell stories that really can evoke a curiosity of learning. And I think being able to almost like pair, there's the classroom content that needs to be done, but there's also the stories that are existing in the libraries. And I think if kids have their almost like their own agency and volition towards a book, towards their learning, I think that can aid teachers so powerfully. And I think being able to think beyond the content of the classroom, which of course is a lot already if we think of what teachers in this country are facing. But I think being able to really have a tripart system, so to say, there's the classroom, there's the content, but there's also beyond the classroom curriculum, which exists in stories. And when kids identify themselves and they see themselves in those stories, and they feel like they're part of the world of those stories, they continue to want to read. And I think how we do that early on in the early life of a child really can shape and increase the cognitive development of how teachers are able to empower kids in the classroom. So, yeah, really fortifying the libraries in schools, the content that they're learning beyond the classroom that can really shape the learning experience of kids, I think can really be of support.
Wanda's grandmother plays a pivotal role in awakening her confidence. To what extent does this reflect your own journey? How did your upbringing and family influence who you are today?
Now, my family is like my very heartbeat, you know? And I think in particular, my grandmother and my mother as well. You know, I was speaking to somebody this weekend. So one of the works that Wonderworld has published is called Unobuntu, which is my mother's book. And we turned that book into a documentary. And I think what seeing my mother as a writer and understanding that she gets that very gift from my grandmother has been such a critically important part of my own identity of being able to claim my power as a writer. And I think what happens in the story of Wanda is this intergenerational transmission of confidence, right? Like where Wanda's grandmother says, look at these women. They have hair just like yours. And then eventually says, look at me. And she's like, oh my God, this is what you were like. And then she says, look at your mother. And she's like, oh, my mom had big hair like me. And then eventually she's able to claim the parts of herself that in this present day society are rejectable. Because I think every single family, in a sense, carries almost like a family mission and that we become gifts into the world. And so those matriarchs in my life are so critically important. For my mom, she's such a believer. She's a massive believer in terms of anything that I do to her. Nothing is impossible. She'll just say to me, you know, Sissy, you really need to show Oprah this show you're doing, you know, like, and to her, because there's so little limitation, like she really thinks like Oprah will find the show, the Altered Book Show, which we're broadcasting on SABC3 and will love it and put it on the O network, you know, like, and I think having mothers, especially who grow with their children, is such a powerful experience as an adult now. And when I say grow, I mean they grow in their own lives as individuals, because then you're able to dream alongside them, to believe alongside them, and to almost share, right, your gifts together. Yeah, I think grandmothers, mothers, aunts, especially, there's such a matriarchal power in being able to see who they are for who they are, not just in their roles, and all the ways in which we can consistently and continuously integrate.
What has been a significant challenge in your work, and how did you overcome it?
I mean, I think the business of creativity, the creative economy, sometimes can be so nebulous, I think, because a lot of the work I do is primarily born out of passion, you know what I mean? And I think really being able to shift from just the passion and the creative aspect of it to saying, what is the business model of this creative enterprise that you're growing? What does it look like? How does it generate revenue? How does it pay salaries? How does it establish itself in a sustainable manner? I think that takes really time to fully develop and to figure out. But I think one of the ways that you're able to really get that right is being able to really lean into what is your skill set. So the book is a representation of that. But what are the skills that you carry into being able to develop that work beyond the book? And how do you systematically and strategically do that in such a way that the business itself then becomes a sustainable growing work, right? So I think one of the things that we people ask me all the time, even on my social media, is how can I write my first book? And for a long time, I'd like kind of almost like mentor people one-on-one until we realized actually we can turn this into a codified course, you know? So I think really being able to harness and clarify how to grow your passion, so worthwhile.
What has been the impact of your story so far, and what plans do you have for the future?
I mean, just this morning I was speaking to a lady who was saying that they've been having problems with their daughter's hair, and afterwards she wanted to her mom to do her hairstyle. She says she usually like throws a tantrum, right? Like, but on this day when they were reading the book, decided actually like I want this particular hairstyle from the book.
Oh, wow.
And I think those aren't, it's difficult to say what the exactitude of the impact is, but I think in terms of people wanting to become something and just how that morphs and molds itself into through the world of the story, to me is such an incredible, I think, impact point. Those are the one-on-one kind of impact experiences. The Children's Book Festival that we do every year, I think part of what we're doing there is shaping an idea, right, like of an African character that has so much potential and prospect to go here and beyond. And I think the excitement of that and the possibility of that is really incredibly energizing. And I can't wait to see what can happen with Wonder to the world. Wonder to the world. Yeah, that's what we call it. And those are some of the measures, but I think the more personalized one are just such an incredible, incredible continuous experience. Yeah.
So we've been asking all of our guests cornerstone questions at the end of each episode. And so now I'd like to ask you, why do you do the work you do and what makes you hopeful?
You know, it's so funny. So 2 weeks ago, we were hosting a writer's workshop for the Eastern Cape province. And one of the facilitators, his name was Umnoza Melani. He's a radio writer. He came and he spoke about writing radio drama. And he was talking about the power of storytelling and what it can do to just shape our minds and imagination. And I literally sat on the edge of my chair thinking, you know, like sometimes you can kind of be almost like some pessimism about the way the world is. And then I thought, even if you never wanted to have children, the best joy of bringing children into the world is so that they would be able to experience a streak of storytelling, like the joy of storytelling and all the ways in which it can evoke a curiosity for learning. I think part of doing this, seeing how people can come alive to themselves, to their own ideas. I don't think we do enough with the potential that children carry. And I think I do what I do because every single time that I come on stage, I literally see teachers, parents, children awaken to the story itself, but also to their own purpose and their own potential. Most of the time, teachers will say, come teach us how to teach like that, right? Like, or you'll do a reading and they'll say, oh my gosh, I thought I was teaching, but what was I doing? And I think being able to evoke other people's own purpose, right, through stories is so invigorating that I never want to stop doing this. It's so incredibly satisfying.
What does social innovation mean to you?
I think social innovation is being able to engage the culture, the times of a people, and be able to shape innovation out of who they are. I think anything that is birthed out of identity most of the time has such power for potential, for affirmation, but also for people being able to see themselves in what is being innovated. So I kind of always think part of South Africa's education, if we think about social innovation for education, I'm like, South African kids dance, you know, South African kids sing, right? Like South African kids are so creative and artistic. And what do we do with this like reservoir and deposit that already exists and being able to tap into that even in the classroom, right? Like, so how do you take that and use it as part of how we're able to get better matric results in the end? And so I think being able to innovate out of who people are is such a necessary and powerful mechanism to being able to really create change. So I think you can't say, oh, we are doing education as we've always done it. It's who are the people you're doing it for? So engineering out of culture is such an important, I think, part of how you can be able to really create social change.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Sihle. It's been an amazing conversation. And as a mom, I'll be looking for your next book for your fans here in Durban. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ndobini. Thank you for such an engaging and just such an inspiring interview and so thoughtful as well, just in the questions that you brought to the conversation.
It's inspiring and exciting that stories like Wanda's are being told and shared with children around the world. Seeing themselves represented more widely will hopefully inspire more young people to lift their voices and express what they think. If we listen carefully to them and each other, we can all be powerful agents for social justice. Thank you for tuning in to Season 4 of the Just for a Change podcast, powered by the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship. If you're interested in hearing more about Unexpected Connections, then make sure you subscribe to this podcast so that you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. If you've enjoyed this episode and this season, please rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. Let's stay inspired and keep changing the way we're changing the world. This podcast is produced by Two Stories in collaboration with the Bertha Center for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Cape Town. Written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kosim Zimela and Duduzile Masuku, with production assistant from Without a Doubt Agency. Special thanks to the Bertha Center team and the Bertha Foundation for their input on this series. For more information on resources used to create this episode, please refer to the show notes.